Good afternoon, everyone. This is Tariq Zaidan. I'm the Director of Communications at the Carnegie Middle East Center here in Beirut. Excuse the little bit of background noise. We're next to a cathedral that's just ringing the 6 o'clock bells. It should be over in 1 minute. I will take this as an advantage to introduce the speakers we have here today with us. The first is Dr. Lina Al-Khafib, who's the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Joining her as well is Dr. Yazid Sayed, a senior associate at the Carnegie Middle East Center. Our associate, Dr. Fred Weary from the Washington office, could not join us today for a scheduling conflict, but he is available separately for interviews should you wish to interview him as well. I'll just take around 30-second break for the background noise to recede, and I'll be right with you.
Right. Oh, no, no. Hello?
Yes, just one moment. It's almost over.
No daily press briefing. No. Hello? Hello?
All right.
Hi.
We'll begin. No problem. All right. I think I'll start things off by asking a question myself before I leave the floor open for questions from everybody else.
Sorry, could everyone just identify themselves, because that's a bit confusing who's speaking at the moment. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. We already introduced everyone. I'm Tariq Zaidan. I'm the Director of Communications for Carnegie in Beirut. With me is Lina Al-Khatib, the director of the center, as well as Yazid Sayed, who is the senior associate for the center. And they will be taking your questions shortly after they answer this first introductory question. This is both to Yazid and Lina. It's remarkable how quickly the ISIS fighters were able to sweep through Iraq and control such a large expanse of land with with little or no resistance. The primary question is, do you think that ISIS will be able to maintain control of this territory in any meaningful and sustainable way, and if so, for how long?
This is Yazid. I'll start by saying that ISIS clearly has shown here, as it has in the past in Syria on several occasions, that it's got a lot of ability to think strategically as well as tactically, to hoard and reserve forces and use them at precise timing in order to build up what you might call kinetic energy, that is to use its relatively small forces in very carefully selected and precise ways to generate the momentum that it can then build on through constant rapid movement and development. And this is very much what it's done in Iraq. The difference is, of course, in Iraq that it's taken over massive amounts of space, major cities, including, of course, Iraq's second city, Mosul, brought about the dissolution of several Iraqi army divisions. This is on a scale that it's never done before in Syria or even in Iraq, really. This suggests first, as I said, a high ability in terms of their, thinking through things, planning. It indicates intelligence ability. In other words, they had must have had very accurate information about conditions, political, morale, etc., within the regime, within government forces, and especially in a place like Mosul. They probably also, whether it was them or through allied Sunni forces had strong contacts within the army, almost certainly, which at least gave them information, if not also secured that, ensured that certain units wouldn't fight. I also want to add here that it's clear also that in advancing so rapidly, ISIS couldn't have done this had there not been large numbers of Sunni militia of different type who are loyal to other Sunni political currents, whether it's former army officers, former Ba'athists, the Naqshbandi army, tribal or clan militias. And the fact that these people were already there, mobilized, ready to move in behind ISIS into places like Mosul to then safeguard them and consolidate the gains they'd made while ISIS then moved on further south indicates that there was a high level of coordination, prior planning, trust, and also that all this could be done with minimal sort of notice or warning on the government side.
Thank you, Yazid. All right, we'll be starting to take questions from everybody. I will just ask you to please introduce yourself before you answer your question and say who you're directing your question to.
Could I ask a question?
Please go ahead. Identify
Hello?
Yourself.
Hi, yeah, I'm Ian Black from The Guardian newspaper in London. I'd like us to ask a question of probably Yazid, but anybody else who's capable of answering it. I've noticed, and I'm sure you have too, that the Saudi government in the last 24 hours has issued an unusual public and very strongly worded statement denying that it in any way supports Daesh after the comments made by Maliki earlier this week. Could you give an assessment of the degree to which the Saudis may have supported ISIS, even inadvertently, and just contextualize this very strong statement that they've issued?
Yeah, okay. Hello, Ian. This is Lina here, Lina Khatib.
Hi.
Okay, when we talk about Saudi support for ISIS, we have to distinguish between support by the Saudi state and support by Saudi nationals, who mm-hmm. have agendas that sometimes differ from those of the Saudi state itself. In the case mm-hmm. of ISIS, there is Saudi money flowing into ISIS. However, this is not money from the Saudi state. So the current statement issued by the Saudi government denying the allegation that it's supporting ISIS is currently an accurate one. Saudi Arabia has, in any case, been under a lot of pressure by the United States and others to stop its support for jihadists in Syria in general. And this has led to a decline of the Islamic Front that had been supported by some Saudi sources, as well as some other groups.
Thank you.
The Saudi non-state support for ISIS is ongoing.
Thank you, Lina.
Okay. This is Shabtai Gold with the German press agency. I was wondering if I could maybe follow up on Ian's question. There's been a lot of reports about ISIS being the richest terror organization in the world, and you know, figures ranging from hundreds of millions to over $1 billion dollars in their hands. How much does ISIS at this point actually rely on donations from, let's say, the Gulf states? And how much, at this point, are they economically independent? Are they able to function without relying on this network of support? And if so, how exactly do they make their money these days?
ISIS currently has an estimated $2 billion in terms of funds. It had, in the beginning, relied on support from Gulf sources, meaning on donations from Gulf sources. However, after it took hold of Raqqa in Syria, especially being able to take over oil-rich areas, and also being able to impose its own taxation on the local population, as well as start taking foreign nationals hostage, these new sources of funding have meant that ISIS has become, both in Syria and in Iraq, completely financially independent and no longer reliant on money flowing in from Gulf sources. So right now, the money coming from foreign donors to ISIS is surplus to its core needs. Even if that money stops, ISIS makes enough money from taxation, ransoms, and sale of resources to be able to become independent and sustainable.
Thank you very much.
Hi, it's Patrick Martin here with the Global Mail newspaper in Canada. Yazid or Lena, can you tell me how real are the gains that the Kurds have been able to effect during this crisis?
I'll say something. Lena's been talking about the Kurdish gains, and so I'll just step in first quickly and then hand back over to her. I mean, it's clear that, well, in my view, certainly, their move into Kirkuk, while portrayed as a defensive move, of course, to secure the city and the oil fields, it obviously serves something they've been trying to do for a very long time. My sense would be there is no going back from that. The Kurds don't need Maliki. Maliki needs them, and it's not obvious they have any reason to give him, you know, give him favors. And so I suspect that any kind of deal-making is going to involve the new reality that the Kurds control Kirkuk. Even if that's not formalized entirely for a while, we'll have to wait and see. What I did want to really add is the importance, I think, for the Kurdish movements in Syria, the PYD and the KDP of Syria, which is Barzani's party, the sister party, are forming a joint operations room to deal with the possibility of, you know, an ISIS threat across the Iraqi border. That, I think, is important because, obviously, those two movements in particular have been at odds, and this latest threat forces them into one trench, basically, and they have been, they've had the foresight to actually go ahead and start coordinating with each other. So if they're able to maintain that, even after the crisis recedes, then I think they'll be in a much stronger position going forward vis-a-vis whatever happens in Syria at a later stage. In other words, in the longer term, securing and protecting their autonomy. You go ahead then with more questions?
Yeah.
Next question, please.
This is Ruth Pollard from the Sydney Morning Herald. Hi. I wanted to ask Lena if she could comment a little bit further on this racketeering that ISIS has used in order to fill its coffers. How much of that racketeering is going to be able to continue in Iraq? Can they sustain this level of earning in Iraq as they have in Syria?
Talking about ISIS funding. ISIS in Syria is currently more financially comfortable than ISIS in Iraq. In fact, prior to the Mosul takeover, ISIS in Syria had started pumping money into ISIS in Iraq, and this money came from Syria itself. So ISIS is obviously stronger in Syria than it is in Iraq, which in a way makes sense because we're talking about a more limited territory in Syria and a more fatigued population that's easier to control. And easier landscape because of the implicit cooperation by the Syrian Assad regime. So ISIS will find it more difficult to sustain the same level of racketeering in Iraq that it has used in Syria. If ISIS is going to have any long-term presence in Iraq in the same way that it is trying to do in Syria, that it's going to face challenges that are definitely different from the ones it has been able to overcome in Syria.
I'd like to add, which is, clearly ISIS already had reasonably important income streams from controlling oil fields, and it's been fighting with Jabhat al-Nusra and other rebel groups in their resort to try and control more, with some success. And now they've got even more money from Mosul. Now, one, I think, reservation should be that ISIS has a big fight ahead in Iraq. They've made the big gains, but from now on they have to hold them, and it's not clear how much they can divert in the way of energy, money, weaponry, and men away from Iraq to Syria. That's one, I think, question. Another is that ISIS, in order to consolidate their power in Syria, need, on the one hand, to build up military forces, which may mean being able to pay salaries to larger numbers of fighters, and obviously they now have much more of that money. They also need to provide services, least to regulate and manage economic activity in areas under the control to ensure that the population actually have a reasonably stable and secure sort of here. I don't think ISIS are inclined to spend their own money providing services. Their attitude has generally been one of hands-off, like letting local groups, including even the provisional government of the national coalition, in Raqqa, so long as it's under their overall control and veto power. They allow local entrepreneurs to buy things like electricity, and they don't. So there's a certain tension between actually allowing a basic provision of economic activity, regulation, and administrative services, healthcare, garbage collection, etc., and paying for all that, their own money. And as for buying loyalty of other fighters by offering salaries. Now, that's something that Jabhat al-Nusra has done a lot. But ISIS's real advantage has been having a hard core of really determined and committed fighters. The moment they start broadening out and bringing in anyone who will come for the money, they risk diluting their military effectiveness and therefore diluting their brand.
Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Forgive me if you've addressed this. I might have missed something. But you were mentioning ISIS, the challenges of consolidating in Iraq. What do you think are going to be the greatest challenges, apart from the question of whether the U.S. Chimes in with any airstrikes, but within the territory they have, do you think their alliances with Sunni militias and Baathists will last? Can they really control this territory? And should the U.S. decide to use either drones, kinetic drones, or airstrikes, do you think that there is anything that they could do effectively that would make any real difference?
Okay. The challenge that ISIS faces in Iraq mainly stems from the ability to sustain local buy-in from the tribes and from the Sunni population. So far, ISIS has managed to cooperate quite successfully with former Baathists, local tribes, and groups such as the Sons of Iraq. However, if you look at the Sons of Iraq, this gives you an interesting case study, because the Sons of Iraq had been seminal in driving out Al-Qaeda for a while after the U.S. invasion of 2003. And then this particular group was sidelined by Maliki, and now this group is, in fact, collaborating with ISIS. So this tells us that even though ISIS is collaborating with certain Islamist groups on the ground, this does not mean that once the dust settles, these groups are going to remain loyal to ISIS. There are, in fact, ideological differences between these groups and ISIS. As for, I will say that the only way ISIS could have seized Mosul is through cooperating with the local population. So without buy-in from the local population, ISIS will find it very hard to hold areas it has controlled and to expand its scope of control. As for U.S. drones, I think U.S. drones could be effective in a limited way, but they would not be effective without a political solution tied into military activities. So unless there is a unity government formed in Iraq, any military action taken by the United States will only have very limited impact, and the conflict will continue to escalate.
Could I just follow up? You wanted to add something. Yeah.
That may anticipate other questions as well. First, the degree right now, the degree of political alienation and distrust among Sunnis of the Maliki government for any short-term political initiative to take root, and with Maliki sort of polarizing the situation by blaming all this on Saudi Arabia rather than try and involve Saudi Arabia and bringing the Sunnis on board, is actually going in the wrong direction. So although I think it's very wise to try and address Sunni concerns politically and crucially, won't necessarily produce results right now, because having gone to war and achieved much results, I think those parts of the Sunni camp that have been behind all this and are allied with ISIS are not going to be ready to pull back and start making compromises. So the critical differences within the Sunni camp are important, and they need to be built on, but it might be something that for the medium term rather than the short term in terms of revealing itself and having impact. The other aspect is that in all this is whether or not something further down the road can be cobbled together that generates a new kind of political dialogue underwritten by Iran on the one side and by Saudi Arabia, that so far has been excluded from this, as well as the U.S. And I fear that although Maliki has clearly driven Iraq into the situation, but not alone, if all the outside powers now start focusing on the demand that Maliki leave as a precondition to enable a political dialogue, I think that means that he has absolutely every incentive to dig in and step militarily. And so we want to avoid, I think, that kind of situation.
You touched on just what I wanted to follow up on. The whole focus on outreach to Sunnis, and President Obama has made that the condition, as you know, of any further action. I don't understand who one could talk to, and even in the medium term, what Sunni groups among Baathists or militias that now feel on a roll is going to be willing to compromise, and who would be able to press them to compromise, let alone press the Shia or Maliki on the other side?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the obvious people like Nujaiti or Alawi and others, and as Lina mentioned earlier, Sons of Iraq, who at one point were, you know, part of the Maliki camp.
Right.
All these people have either been alienated or have been weakened as Maliki chipped away at their parliamentary blocks and so on. So even those who might be open to dialogue are now too weak to deliver. In some cases, they're just as venal and corrupt and not, you know, aren't necessarily people with a great deal of legitimacy and credibility. So unfortunately, right now, this is why I suggested that although it's the right thing to do politically, which is to start putting together a political discourse and set of ideas and initiatives and feelers and outreach, etc., aimed at bringing the Sunnis into the political process, but not as if first time. I mean, the various Sunni politicians and parties have been engaged with 10 years. There are those among them who, from the start, felt that this whole new Iraq is minority status and is therefore wrong and unacceptable. And those who aren't, I think, going to convince now. The problem is that so for a while, I think, we'll see much progress. But the issue isn't of identifying a few characters to talk to. It's rather that we know perfectly well what Sunni demands have been over the last 10 years.
Right.
It's about the lack of credibility of Maliki, and not just of Maliki, and lack of trust around him in ever delivering on things that have been promised in the past. So
right.
We have to reinvent the wheel. We have to get genuine commitment to implementing things agreed on in the past. And here is where I think outside players need to shift the focus from move Maliki away, get rid of Maliki, rather than say, here are the things that have been agreed on or could be improved on and built on. This is what needs to happen and moving forward. This may allow, for instance, bringing the Saudis on board as a positive, constructive player rather than as a spoiler in this whole political process. Bringing the Sunnis in, assuring them, and becoming a party to bringing about a new political order inside Iraq, alongside Iran, rather than forever sort of being outside the tent, as it were, trying to disrupt things because they think everything in Iraq has gone to the dogs and gone to Iran.
Sorry, again, this is Ashraf Tavit, DPA. Just to follow up on that again, is there any role for the Arab neighbors to be, a positive role for the Arab neighbors that they can play in the short term to help Iraq?
Saudi Arabia can play a very important role in what is happening in Iraq today by basically continuing its back-channel talks with Iran, driven by the shared concern of both countries about the spread of ISIS. I think if Saudi Arabia and Iran reach an agreement about power sharing in Iraq, that would mean an agreement that could circumspect the challenge that Yazid spoke about, which is the challenge of what to do about Maliki. There may be a formula whereby Maliki's political party remains in power, but Maliki himself steps down. This formula, I think, would be acceptable or is likely to be acceptable to Iran as well as Saudi Arabia. And if that were to happen, if a power-sharing agreement is reached with the Sunnis in Iraq, this can resurrect the offer by members of the Sunni community that Maliki had refused just a few days ago when they came to him and offered to have a Sunni militant force fighting back ISIS on the ground, essentially empowering the Iraqi army through a significant Sunni presence. Maliki refused that. So if that could be resurrected with the blessing of Saudi Arabia in agreement with Iran, I think it would be a major move forward for all stakeholders in this conflict, from, all Arab stakeholders.
Could you elaborate, this is Trudy Rubin again, on that offer, which I had not seen written about, by Sunnis to fight alongside the army against ISIS?
Yes. This was an offer made early on in the crisis by several leaders of the Sunni community in Baghdad. They went to Maliki and, including some Islamist groups, they went to Maliki and offered to form a kind of Sunni army, if you like, they said that if they did that, then they would be able to fight ISIS more legitimately, because then it would not be seen as a Shia versus Sunni issue, and that way they would avoid sectarian tensions from flaring up. However, Maliki refused, because Maliki so far has exerted a lot of pressure over the Iraqi army to the extent that certain members of the Iraqi army who are not Shia, meaning certain Sunni members of the Iraqi army, have said that they do not belong to the Iraqi state. And that explains their actions in Mosul, the fact that the Iraqi army in Mosul chose not to fight. A lot of the Sunni soldiers there felt that they had nothing to fight for and that they were not willing to defend Maliki himself. So that was the offer that Maliki refused, because he felt that it would dilute his control over the Iraqi army.
Was this former Sons of Iraq commanders? Like tribal, this wasn't, say, Abu Risha or Ali Hatem, was it?
No, these are not the Sons of Iraq commanders, because the Sons of Iraq commanders are now allied with ISIS. I'm talking about other Sunni groups, some of the moderate, not just Islamist groups, who had made that offer to Maliki.
We have time for one last question before we have to leave. Does anybody have anything to add?
I have another one if no one else has. Qasem Soleimani has been in Baghdad, and there has been no indication in the past that, given that he has the Iraq file in Iran, there's been no indication that he has been interested in outreach or compromise with the Sunnis. So even if you have Rouhani or senior aides of Rouhani, like Abu Talabi, talking about cooperation with the Americans, which leads one to believe there could be some kind of formula involving Sunnis, you have in Baghdad Soleimani, who seems disinterested in that. Can anyone talk about how that circle could be squared? Or is there any indication that you've seen that Qasem Soleimani has a brief from the Supreme Leader or is willing to change the direction that he has gone in the past regarding compromise with Sunnis in Iraq?
I'm certainly not clear on that detail. However, I think that any overt Iranian involvement in Iraq at this stage is going to be calibrated in a way that allows it to be portrayed as a constructive act, as part of a collective effort, or at least a response to a collective concern in ways that are acceptable to other parties. Iranians don't want to go in a way that simply diverts the confrontation to be one of Iran and pro-Iranian Iraqis versus others such as the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Maliki might be trying to push in that direction by making this, blaming Saudi Arabia. I think the Iranians have a lot more to gain strategically by showing their ability and their asserting their right to deploy some force to protect Baghdad, by keeping this on a government-to-government basis first, and second, by keeping it limited in size and scale and location. They're also signaling something that can be complementary to what others are doing. So if the U.S. goes in with airstrikes, there's no reason for the Iranians, as it were, not to provide some sort of defense for Baghdad. The question, I think, that becomes interesting if you look further down the line, whether by common agreement the Iranians expand their role there, and moreover, at least hypothetically at this stage, if it becomes legitimate for Iran to deploy military force in Iraq in support of the government might that also become possible in Damascus one day down the line? And it'd be ironic for the U.S. to tacitly at least accept this in Iraq, but then start fighting it in Syria. So there may be complications down the line. But for now, I think the Iranians will step very carefully.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. If you have any follow-up questions, I encourage you to get in touch with my colleagues, Clara in D.C. or Jumana here in Beirut. Thank you for joining us once again, and look forward to talking to you all soon.
Thank you very much for organizing.
You're welcome.